Welcome to the Hope on the Hard Road podcast, where you and your family can find community, find encouragement, and find hope for the road ahead. Speak encouraging words to one another. Build up hope so that you will all be together in this. 1 Thessalonians 5:11.
Hi guys, we're in our future planning series and so glad to have Wendy Dumlau back on the podcast. Today, Wendy is talking about SSI. Wendy is an incredible advocate for families of children with special needs. You're going to love her caring, fun, and engaging way of presenting the insights that bring hope as we plan for the future of our children. Let's get started.
Wendy, we are so glad to see you back on the podcast.
Hi, you guys. It's good to be back.
Wendy, we know we've had you on before, and we highly recommend that families go back and listen to those podcasts we've done before with you. But for those that haven't met you yet, why don't you go ahead and share a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I'm a lawyer, and I work in San Diego County, Riverside County, a little bit in Orange County, and I do special education cases. So I help families or students get the services they need. I do regional center cases all over California, and I do some public benefits cases, which are Social Security benefits, SSI, Medi-Cal, in-home support services. So mostly I do hearings, but I also do appeals to district court on some of these things. So that's really my background. I'm helping people with disabilities, and I primarily focus on developmental disabilities, but I'll do cases that have any type of disability.
Well, that's great. You know, and you just mentioned it. We're talking today about SSI. So maybe if you can give us kind of an overview of what SSI is, whether it's children or adults.
Yeah, so SSI is just, it's like an abbreviation for Supplemental Security Income. And it's a Social Security benefit. So it's a monthly monetary benefit that's paid. And it's primarily for to cover like the cost of food, rent, and clothing. So it's available to children and adults who are either disabled or blind.
Oh, that's so good to know the basics of that. And looking into that, you know, what is some of the criteria for actually qualifying for SSI benefits? You know, is there a specific age or disability? And also, on a side note, can parents' income and assets affect that eligibility at all?
Yeah. So there's a couple things with eligibility. So there's two things that are looked at. First, are they medically eligible? So we're looking at disability or blindness. And then the second piece is, are they income and resource eligible? So there are some Social Security benefit programs where resources don't matter. Income might matter, but resources don't matter. For SSI, it is not an entitlement program. That means you have to be low income under their standards to be eligible for it. So just being disabled is not good enough for meeting their medical criteria. You also have to meet the financial criteria, which I'll talk a little bit about that. But focusing on the medical side, there's actually, we call it the listing, and there's Part A and Part B. And I can't remember off the top of my head if Part A is child, but I think it is. So it's like it's the blue book, and people can just Google SSA blue book, and it has children's listings and it has adult listings. And it basically lists all the disabilities and the criteria. And if you meet all those criteria, you're eligible medically. You can also be eligible medically if your impairment you don't meet the criteria exactly, but you can prove that your limitations are like that eligibility criteria. So close enough, right? Mm. But the best way is if you just meet the listing, because then there's no argument. So that's what's looked at first, is the medical eligibility side. Once that's determined, they determine if if the income and resource, if somebody's eligible under income and resources. And by income, I mean earned income, which is wages, employment, and then unearned income, which could be things like child support or other kinds of monetary benefits, right? Like general assistance or welfare or whatever. So those are looked at. And then when you're looking at a child, you're looking at what their income is, their income and resources, and you're looking at what the parents' income and resources are. So we'll sort of get to that, but that's because I'll talk a little bit later probably about how much of a benefit somebody can get. And that's determined by the parents' income and resources if they're under 18. If they're over eight, if they're 18 or older, the income and resources of their parents, even if they live with them, do not matter.
Okay. Yeah. So that's some fantastic advice, knowing that that 18-year-old distinguishing point, you know, is crucial, and that how it incorporates the parents before 18, but after 18, the parents are no longer a factor in terms of their eligibility for it.
Yeah. So, just on just another note about that.
Yeah.
A lot of people are eligible for SSI, but then we look at the parents' resources, and it's because it's a very low resource amount, which I'll talk about, but it just, they're just not eligible. Even if they're eligible income wise, they're not eligible because of resources. So as soon as they turn 18, you can apply for them at 18.
Yeah. You know, and Wendy, to the medical aspect to it, is it sometimes tricky to, you know, sort of prove that? Like what do parents do to go ahead with proving the medical need?
So I always say the more documents you can give them, the better, because you want them to make the right decision the first time. And unfortunately, it depends on who you get that's reviewing your case. And you could give them everything that proves, like, let's take autism, for instance. There's a listing that says what you have to prove to meet the medical criteria for autism. And it's very similar to what you'd have to prove to even be diagnosed with autism, right? Mm-hmm. But we have people who have autism who get denied benefits, and it's very odd. And there's like a report that they have autism, and there's regional center services. And so sometimes it really depends on who's reviewing the case. But I say always give all the information that shows the disability, when it was first diagnosed, and then what the deficits are currently because of it.
Yeah, that is so good to know, because, you know, personally, we went through that a bit. So just the questioning of the medical diagnosis that had been there since Abby was three. So that's really good information for families to know.
Yeah. And one of the questions that just came up as you're going through this is, how is the qualifying for Medi-Cal also overlap with SSI?
So the income, the resource requirements are the same for Medi-Cal. The income requirements are a little different. There are income requirements because Medi-Cal is also a low income program for people who are disabled or blind. And I think also people over a certain age. So we call it elderly, but I don't like to say elderly. So it's like elderly, disabled, and blind, or aged. They call it aged. So Medi-Cal's resource rules are the same as SSI. So the SSI resource rules is, if it's an individual, they cannot have more than $2,000 in savings. Once they do, it kicks them out, regardless of what their income is, right? If you have a child who has a two-parent household, the resource limit is the resource limit for a couple, which is $3,000, and then the resource limit for the recipient or individual, which is $2,000. Okay. So that's always important to consider. If it's a single parent and a child, it's $2,000 for the child, $2,000 for the single parent, which I don't think they ever explain that. They say the resource limit for her is $2,000. That's not really accurate. The limit is whatever the parent's resource limit is plus the individual's resource limit. So let's take you guys, right? You're a couple, you live together, your resource limit is $3,000. Your child's resource limit, if she was a minor, would be $2,000. So you could have $5,000 in savings.
Mm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Definitely good information. Now, I know SSI with receiving funds can be really tricky on what you can spend it on, how much you can keep. things like that. So can maybe go over some of that spending idea of the resource money that comes in?
Yeah, and then I'll also talk about how it's spent, how it can affect your actual benefit amount. And then also maybe I'll jump into deeming, which is like counting the parent's income against the child, right? So anytime there's deeming, it means the person is under 18. As soon as they're 18, the parent's income and resources don't matter anymore. But if they're under 18, there's this calculation called the deeming calculation. And some of the parent's income will get deemed to the child, and that will affect their benefit amount. So the first thing is, what can it be spent on? It's very specific: food, rent, and clothing. They don't, if you're spending it on other things, they'll take it away. That's what it's for. So they don't ever ask for like rental receipts and things like that, but they do ask you every year for an accounting. So they'll send you a form and they'll say, this individual received this amount this year in SSI. How much of this was spent on rent? How much of this was spent on food? How much of this was spent on clothing? They don't seem to care too much about clothing, but they want to know it's going towards food and rent, and that the minor child, is paying their fair share for it. So if they're not paying their fair share with it, they reduce it, which seems very backwards, right? Like, if somebody can't pay their rent and food, why do you reduce the benefit amount? You'd think you would give them more so they could cover their rent and food.
But exactly.
Yeah. But the rule is if you don't have enough to cover it, then we reduce it. We don't want someone else paying your rent and food. This is what this is for. You have to pay it. So we call that the 1/3 reduction rule. It's called some other things too, but that's what I call it because it's easy for parents to understand. And it can affect, if you don't spend it and spend your fair, and you don't spend it on your fair market share, they'll reduce it.
Mm-hmm. And that term fair market share is so important to know. How do we come about finding that fair market share?
So it depends. And throughout my years of doing this, I've sort of figured out different ways to prove fair market. If there's a family that's renting, let's say they're renting a house and the total rent is a certain amount, and there's however many people in the house, you divide their fair share by that amount, right? And then for food, you sort of just have to estimate like how much do we spend just on this child? So you have to sort of estimate that. So that's how you find like the typical fair share. The interesting thing is sometimes families have bought houses, and because they bought them so early on, they have a very low mortgage,
right?
But renting a room in that area, let's say Solana Beach, right? Renting a room in Solana Beach is going to be like, I don't know, $2,000, maybe more. But somebody bought a house and their mortgage is like $1,200 and they have like four people living there. So the fair market share for rent, for that person's rent, is a quarter of whatever that mortgage is. And that's it. So some people got really lucky because they had like a very low mortgage, and you can, and Social Security will accept that, but you have to prove that's what the mortgage is, and you have to tell them how many people are living there and all of that.
Yeah, no, thank you so much, seriously, for breaking that down, because it gets so confusing for our families and for us. It's been confusing. So, I think as we're looking at this, are there any income limits or asset restrictions for the child's SSI eligibility? And how does CalABLE fit into the equation?
Yes. So income restrictions, let's talk about that first. So this is the deeming part, right? So, and we're talking about children, so people under 18. There's this calculation that's done that considers the parent's income and how much of it should be counted against the child. And then that amount is used to reduce that child's SSI benefit. So I can walk you through the calculation if you want.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. So the first thing we do is we look at what is the federal benefit rate for, and everyone's eligible for that, children, adults, whatever. So we start with the federal benefit rate, which is $914 a month for SSI. Then every state, some don't have a supplement, some do. It's based on cost of living. In California for 2023, The state supplement is $578.82. So those combined are $1,492.82 for 2023. But they're using the federal benefit rate in this calculation. So it's really important to know what the federal benefit rate is, and then you add the state supplement to it after. So you take parents' total income, okay, whatever that amount is. The first thing, these are like little disregards that are going to reduce the countable income slowly until we get to the final number. So the first disregard is $457 for every non-disabled child. So they basically say for every child in your home that's a minor, that's not getting public benefits, we're going to let you keep $457 for them, which, right. Right? What? Is that enough? Probably not. But that's what they're, so for every non-disabled child, they minus out $457. What's left from that, they do, if there's any unearned income you guys are receiving, they'll disregard $20, okay? And if there isn't, then they disregard it later for the recipient or the person receiving the SSI. So then they take another $65 off as like a, I don't know, a gift maybe for your earned income. Okay. So now all these things are minused off and you have a different amount. This amount that's left, they only count half of it. So now that's divided in half. Wow. Then they take that amount and they reduce it for if it's a single parent, they let the parent have $914 of it. So they minus out $914. That's the federal benefit rate. If it's a couple that are the parents, they do the couple federal benefit rate, which is $1,371. Okay, they minus that off. Now we know what's going to be deemed to the child. Whatever's left from all of those little calculations is whatever amount will be deemed to the child. You take the federal benefit rate, you minus off that income that's left, and then whatever's left from that is what is the SSI federal benefit rate they're entitled to, plus the state supplement. So sometimes, I mean, there is a point where your income is so high that you cap out. It just depends on, it depends on a lot of factors. How many people are getting SSI in the home? How many minor children are in the home? How much is the total earned income, right? Like, so all of those things go into this calculation and it helps you determine if that child will be eligible for SSI as a minor living in that home. So that's the deeming calculation.
Wow.
That's related to income. Then we have asset restrictions or resources, right?
Right.
And there's a whole list on Social Security's website about what assets count as a resource and which ones don't. So some of the easy ones I can just mention are you can own one home. A family can own one home, or an individual recipient can own one home and it doesn't get counted. If you have two, the second one's, the value of the second one will be counted against. You can own one car unless there's two people who have two different jobs. They can each have a car, right? Mm-hmm. So there's that. Those are sort of disregard assets. And then savings accounts, basically. So if you have, for your situation, if you have more than 5,000 in savings and you're child's a recipient or an applicant for SSI and they're a minor, then they wouldn't be eligible. So right. there's a restriction on how much savings you can have.
Mm. Yeah, that's so good to know. And again, you mentioned they're a minor. This is different than when they're over 18. Yeah.
Yeah. So the other thing with the income, which I don't know if I mentioned it, but some children live in a single parent household and they're not actually an absent parent, but they're called an absent parent because they don't live in the household. So they might see them on the weekends and they give child support. Mm-hmm. It's a terrible term. I don't know why they use it, but it's called absent parent. Yeah, it's horrible. They take the minor child, they'll take that child support into consideration when they're considering how much SSI that person should get. So once they deem all the income, then they also look at is, are they getting unearned income, which is like child support, basically. So that also goes, it will be considered. I think you asked about the CalABLE account, right?
Yeah. And that's a big one. So, you know, families know, you know, just so families know, we did a segment of a podcast episode last season on CalABLE. And so this is important for families to hear. How does SSI work together with CalABLE, or really vice versa?
Yeah. So CalABLE or a special needs trust are going to be assets that don't count as resources. Now, a special needs trust has to be set up correctly, and the money that's put into it has to be put into it correctly. But a special needs trust, if done correctly, will ensure that whatever that savings is doesn't limit their ability to get benefits. The CalABLE account is the exact same thing. It just, you can only put a, it's like capped on how much you can put in per year. And I don't necessarily know the amount. I want to say it's like 14,000 or 15,000 or something like that. Yeah, but I'm not sure like that total amount, but I know you can only put a certain amount into that account. But anything in that account can be used as long as you used your public benefits first. And it doesn't count against you. So it's not like somebody's paying your rent, somebody's paying your food, and now they're going to reduce your benefit. It's actually a legitimate way to pay bills and also get your maximum benefit, just like it would be if you paid bills out of like the special needs trust.
Yeah, that's fantastic stuff. So, because certainly, I mean, we're going to talk about here, and you know, what is the maximum SSI? But certainly, the maximum SSI is not going to be enough to cover your expenses, whether a child or an adult. So,
not here in California, that's
no,
for
definitely
sure.
Not. So, yeah, as we're looking and maybe talk about what is the maximum SSI. You talked about how it may not be the maximum, and does that change from a child to an adult?
It only changes if the parents may have too much income, right? So for children, I'll talk about for children first. The total amount in California for SSI, if deeming doesn't apply and if this one-third reduction rule doesn't apply, is $1,492 and some change. It goes up every year because the state supplement goes up every year. And I think the federal benefit rate goes up every year too, based on cost of living. So every year it's going to increase a little bit. So for children, if there's no income being deemed, they'll get the max amount. If there's no one-third reduction rule, they'll get the max amount. And since we're on that one-third reduction rule, the best way to try to get the maximum amount is to have a CalABLE account that can fund some of the rent if it's higher than this $1,492, right? Or to pay for some of the food, because the $1,492 is fully covering the rent. So if you're able to show that, you'll get the max amount. If you're not, it'll be reduced by a third, which is a bummer, but it will be. For adults so let's say you have an adult child living in your home and they're still getting special education. They will not be eligible for CalFresh benefits, which are like food stamps, right? They used to be food stamps. Now they're an ATM card and they can be used at like most grocery stores and whatever, just for food. So CalFresh, if you're living at home and still in special ed, you can't get it because your parents' income counts against you and usually you're not eligible. If you're 18 and not living at home, you can get CalFresh and SSI. And neither one affects each other. You're entitled to both. If you're 22, not in special ed and living at home, you're now considered an adult living at home, and you can get CalFresh to cover your food and still get SSI.
Oh man. So that's the sweet spot.
Yes. And so it totally depends on like, how old are you? What's your parents' income? Like, are you still in special ed? Like, so all of those things, but now because of a change in law, you can, if you're eligible, receive CalFresh and SSI. It used to be, if you had SSI, you could not get CalFresh, but you can now.
Oh, yeah. Because you hear a lot from families, you know, I can't get CalFresh. We should be able to. I can't get it. Mm-hmm. So that was such a good breakdown, Wendy, for families to hear and for us to hear. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the next thing we're just thinking about is just, you know, will your child's SSI benefits affect any other government subsidies that you're getting for your child? You know, is there any conflict there or vice versa?
Yeah. So not that I can think of. So for SSI, it's at a certain limit for a reason. And if you have SSI, you can have SSI linked Medi-Cal, right? So even Medi-Cal has decided, or Medicaid has decided, like SSI is low income, so you're still eligible for public health care benefits too. Now you could also get SSI and CalFresh, so it doesn't affect that. The only thing I could think of, which is probably like a whole nother podcast, but is like disabled child benefits, right? Those are under a different umbrella of a Social Security benefit. And sometimes, I'll just quickly touch on it, parents retire or they're disabled and they have a child who's disabled, and now the child can get those benefits under their parent's Social Security number, and they're usually higher than SSI, and they kick them into a category where now they're going to have a share of cost with Medi-Cal. Mm. So I have ideas, and I've used them in the past, on how to get into other no share of cost, full scope Medi-Cal programs, even when that happens. But like I said, that's like a completely different topic. But I can't think of any benefits that will be affected by somebody receiving SSI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, I know trying to get these benefits is quite a process, and we've been and are still kind of going through this entire process. But can you walk through kind of the process of applying for it and how long that process actually takes before you start seeing a benefit?
Yeah, and I'll just base it off what we do in our office. It could be different for parents, but so in our office, we have the child disability report or the adult report, and that's really your application for SSI. Like, we have the paper copy. You can't do an SSI application online. You can do an you can do a Social Security disability application online and check the box that says I want to also apply for SSI, but it sort of delays the process, right? So the best thing to do is to call your Social Security office and tell them, I want to apply for SSI, please send me the forms. We have the forms because we've done them so many times that we just like saved them, and we have them to use for clients. So we work with the parent to fill the form out. We make sure we have all the medical records that prove disability, when it was diagnosed, all the deficits. If it's someone with autism, we have ABA reports, behavior reports, IEP documents, IPP documents, like anything that supports the disability and that the person meets the listing. And then we mail it in. So we do like certified return receipt and mail it in. Once we know they've gotten it, I would say it takes about 60 days or so for them to review stuff and then send out, like, you need to sign these medical releases. You know, we got your application. We're still reviewing. There's not like a set time frame, and I think if you delay in responding to them, it significantly delays your application.
Oh wow, seriously.
Yeah. And it's Social Security again, like, they lose things. They are notorious for losing things. They're notorious for saying they send notices out that people magically never receive. And so that's the problem, right? Is that it's not consistent on how they do the application. So what I try to tell people is, when you come in the door and we finally have everything, give it 90 days, because that's probably how long it's going to take before we even hear anything back. And a lot of times, even if you've given them everything to prove it, they deny it. So now, right, you're okay. Now we have to appeal. So now you're at the reconsideration stage, and that's going to then kick it out further and further and further. And we can talk about the appeal process and like how much more time that adds, but just the application process, I would say 90 days if you send everything in is probably a good time period. I don't know. What did it take you guys?
It was quite a process. And actually, that kind of brings up something that maybe parents would want to know. I was able to sign up for a digital correspondence, be able to connect to her account, my daughter's account. Of course, when we were doing it, she was conserved and she was 18, but actually able to get on an account. Now, there's not a lot of information, but you could at least see kind of the timeline, where they're at in the process. And we also were able to get when she first qualified for benefits, what benefits she was going to be getting, because we did not get something in the mail, but it was on that website to kind of clue us in on what was going on. So finding and yeah, connecting to that portal, I look for more information that I wish was there also, but it wasn't. But there is at least some information that gives you a clue where they are in the process.
But yeah, you started basically the day she turned 18, oh, right? Yeah. And then the first correspondence we got was maybe, it was definitely a couple months after that. And then we got the, does she really have autism? Yes. We have plenty of proof of that. And we want to have our own medical team examine her. And essentially, we just referred them back to Rady Children's and all the local doctors and things that we've ever seen with her and all the reports. And then what would you say? And then the process, finally, the interview.
Well, and it continues. And a lot of times with this process too, you, like a lot of the other government things, you start the process with one person who's assigned to you. And, you know, in our case, it's been over a year. It gets reassigned and there's somebody else on the job before it's all said and done. So,
yeah. So not to scare families,
no.
But just to educate them that this is not necessarily a very cut and dry process like an IEP is, right? There's not these strict deadlines and things like that. And you've just got to kind of take a breath, persevere.
I agree. And I really do think, unfortunately, with Social Security, they're the worst agency to work with, unfortunately. And you do not even know how many times we've had to just file for hearing and then it gets there and it's like, and that's a delayed process too. And it's just like the judge is like going, why is this here? Right?
Right.
So it is frustrating, but you can't give up and you've got to keep notes on every time you've called and who you talk to. I mean, that's what we do now. We have like just a running log of like who we spoke to, what day, what they told us for clients who they've lost their paperwork or we sent you a notice and you never appealed it. And it's like, well, my office didn't get a notice and I'm the authorized representative. So, and my client's saying they didn't get a notice. So
that's right. That's right. And that happened too, right? That happened on in our case as well. We were supposed to get the post-interview. So once they interview, they're supposed to send out, right, Wendy, a post-interview form. It's basically almost a packet because it's about, what, 5-7 pages? Go ahead and speak to that.
Yeah. So when they do your interview, they talk about income, resources, who's living there. This is really just to finish off that eligibility piece, right? Like we've done the medical. And you mentioned something about medical. A lot of times they want their own people to do an assessment, which then also delays the medical decision. Then they want to do this interview and they take all these notes and they're supposed to send you, this is a requirement, they're supposed to send you this post-interview document that has their questions, your answers, and they even say on it, please review it and let us know if anything is incorrect. I think they give you 30 days or something. But it's important that you get it and review it because they could have typed something in wrong that makes the person ineligible and they should not have been ineligible, right? But it sounds like you guys didn't even get that.
Nope. And then Eric, as he said, he finally went on the portal and that's how we found out what they were basically approving her for, which was far below, which, yeah.
Well, and actually something that clued in that we didn't have the right paperwork is I went into, you know, in our case, it's an adult and conserving and opening a bank account. And I didn't have the correct paperwork to be the designated payee. And The banks have worked with it frequent enough to know what that actually looks like. And I'm like, wait a minute, I never got that. This is still the process of getting that next step paperwork that can open the bank. So I had to go in specifically, both of us at different times had to go in to get that correct paperwork just to open the bank account so that when she does get the benefits check, you know, we could take care of that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I know, right? So then really what you know, we know what we ended up doing from there. But so we just want to speak in broader terms. What happens if your child's SSI application is denied? You know, can you appeal the decision? Like, what are the next steps?
So it used to be that you could skip, well, in California, at least, it used to be that you could skip directly to a hearing with a judge. You can no longer do that. I don't know why they want to delay the process, but so if you get a denial from your initial application, you have 65 days to request a reconsideration. And there's a couple different boxes. It could be just done by them reviewing more paperwork. They'll do like a telephone conference with you, or you can go in and meet with somebody. So it's like review of paperwork. That's one option. I forget what they call it. The second one's like informal conference. And the third one's like formal conference, right? Like those are your options for a reconsideration. We always just do the paperwork one because we're just literally trying to check boxes so we can ask for a hearing with a judge. So we do that and provide more documents. And
absolutely.
But that's the first step. And it's 60 days to appeal and they give you 5 days for mailing. So a lot of times you can do these online and then it'll give you like a receipt for what you appeal, like what your appeal paperwork shows, and you can save that. And then they'll give you a cover sheet that has the person's name on it, their address, and like these little lines where you can write what you're sending in. So basically it's like your personalized cover sheet to send in documents. So that's a reconsideration. You have 65 days to get it done. If that then gets denied, you request a hearing with an ALJ. So that's an administrative law judge. And it is a hearing. You go in person in front of an ALJ. And you also have 65 days to ask for that after if you get another denial notice. If you're not successful at hearing, then you can request an appeal with the appeals council, which those are, you don't have to do it. You can jump directly to district court, which is what I do. But you can, if you're a parent, you can ask for an appeal with the appeals council too. And your notice will say, or the hearing decision will say like how much time you have. I don't remember what it is off the top of my head. Maybe 60 days or something. If you get a termination of your SSI or a reduction of your SSI that's already in place.
Yes.
You want to appeal within 10 days because it keeps your benefits coming in while you wait for them to change their mind or a judge to make a decision, right? However, it's really important for people to understand if you're not eligible based on income or whatever, you will have an overpayment for receiving those benefits while you waited. But if you feel confident that they're medically eligible and they've got the calculation wrong, appeal within 10 days so you continue to receive your benefit.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things you just mentioned is that the overpayment part of it, but in this whole process, everything you're talking about, 60 days here, 60 days, 60 days here, they're going to be eligible and back pay eligible, correct?
Correct.
And so what is the process, you know, going that and making sure you get the back pay and the right back pay?
Yeah. So what's really important is, well, again, you should be getting a notice that says what your benefit rate is that they've determined and what your back pay is and what that was based off of.
Right.
They're supposed to give you a whole notice that has all these calculations of how they came up with your retroactive benefits. And if their calculation of your retroactive benefits is not accurate, you can appeal that. And what they should be doing is considering this deeming calculation and any other income and developing it off that, or this one-third reduction rule. So I always say after someone's made eligible, Social Security is supposed to do an after eligibility interview to ask all these income and are they paying their fair share of rent and how much are they paying and all of that. It's good to get advice from somebody who does this before you do that interview. So you tell them the correct stuff so you get the full back pay. Because sometimes what happens is they say, well, she wasn't paying her fair share. You guys didn't have an agreement that she'd pay her fair share leading up to this point. So we're going to only give her this amount. But now that you have an agreement for them to pay their fair share, we'll bump her amount up going forward. And some families are like, fine, whatever. I don't care. I'm not going to appeal it. But some families are like, no, this is what she was entitled to from the day we applied. And so that times however many months is what her benefit should be.
Yeah. Or in our case, we were very specific in the interview process and it did not get translated, right? And we never received that letter that would prove that. And so, yeah, so it's important. Obviously, we understand families are, you know, we're all exhausted. We're working so hard to cover our kids and in every way possible. But yeah, it is legitimately owed to our children and our adult children in this case. And so, yeah, keep going, keep persevering, families, for sure.
Yeah.
Definitely, which kind of leads us to this last question. You know, as we always interview people, and you've been on before as well, so probably applying it towards this type of thing, what's one thing you'd really like to share with our listeners, kind of as a take home, you know, that would help them as they move forward and bring hope?
Yeah, and I'll just relate it sort of to like Social Security benefits or SSI, but I think we've talked about it a little bit, which is like, don't give up. These agencies are usually wrong, or at least in my opinion, they're wrong. And so don't give up. Find someone to help you. You know, there are attorneys that do these cases, and we get paid fees based on the retroactive benefit. So like, parents don't have to pay out of pocket to get an attorney to come to hearing with them, right? Because we know if we win, we're eventually going to get paid. It will come out of the retroactive benefits, but you don't have to pay anything up front. There are a lot of attorneys, including myself, that do it on contingency. So we get paid after. And one of the things about these cases is to get to a judge, it can take like a year. So we're talking about a big chunk of back payment, right?
Absolutely.
So a little bit taken out for an attorney, which is capped at $6,000, by the way. So it's not like... it's 25% capped at $6,000. So like, they're never going to make more than $6,000 unless they made some side agreement, which we're not supposed to do. So, you know what I mean? So like, it is affordable. If you've got a chunk, you know, if I'm eligible, I know there's going to be a chunk of back benefit that her fees will come out of. And if I'm not eligible, she's not going to get any money anyways. So it's, you know, it's sort of a scenario where why not hire an attorney for that? You know?
Right.
So I guess that would be my thing, is like, don't give up and talk to other families and find out who they used or find out what they did. And if you're exhausted, find a lawyer who's willing to take a contingency, who knows what they're doing.
Yeah. So good, Wendy. Mm-hmm. So good. It just, you know, having the facts in front of you as a parent is just so important. And that brings hope. It does. So thank you so much for coming on today and explaining this.
I love doing these. Thanks for having me again.
Oh, well, it's our pleasure. Seriously. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Resources and contact information for today's podcast will be included in the show notes. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share us with others and be sure to follow us so you won't miss an episode. And we'd love to hear from you, so please leave us a comment or rating and connect with us on social media or on our website at hopeonthehardroad.org.